So a lot of things happened in the 1960s. It was a tumultuous time in the U.S. and throughout the world. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know about the 1960s is that it was also a time of pretty prominent UFO sightings.
Yeah, you're around 15, maybe a little more years away from the Roswell incident. People are aware of the words to use when describing seeing something strange. And oh my goodness, we've got a special sighting for you today.
That's right. On December 9th of 1965, we have reports of multiple witnesses seeing a bright and shiny object shooting through the sky and apparently landing in a little town called Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. Let's find out what happened.
From UFOs to ghosts and government cover-ups, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
And I'm Ben.
And today we are, well, at least in the room, we don't have super producer Noel with us.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, our super producer Noel E.T. Brown has moved on to a better place.
He's directly outside.
He's directly outside. Yeah, he's directly outside. Still on the show, watching us through a nifty new window because he is moving on up. But you know what, Matt? Even though he's outside, something tells me that he can hear us. Call it faith. Call it the pair of headphones I see him wearing, and the fact that he's nodding when we say stuff.
Oh, that is weird. He did respond in real time.
Is it coincidence? Is it an accident? Is there something else out there? Some other explanation? And speaking of amazing segues, today we're working on UFOs, right?
That's correct. Specifically, an incident that took place in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, that has baffled people ever since the day that it occurred.
Yeah, it's tantalized people. It has irritated skeptics and ufologists alike because even today, spoiler alert, most people don't agree about what happened, including surviving eyewitnesses. So what we're going to do is explore the facts of this, some of the ways that this changed, and in the end, ask what you think, because this is a fascinating case. But okay, so Matt, just the facts. What happened?
At around 4:45 p.m. on December 9th, 1965, residents of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, around 40 miles outside of Pittsburgh, saw something bizarre, unexpected and frightening. A ball of fire shot through the sky. This thing, purportedly acorn-shaped, appeared to make a controlled crash, slowing down before it hit the ground. Now, this isn't just one person that's giving this report to a police officer or something, you know.
Sure.
It's calling 911. Hey, I saw this crazy thing. This event had hundreds of witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because numerous people saw it. And the question would be, what was it? Because we know that these people all saw something. They didn't just collectively pretend that something happened around 5 p.m. on December 9th. But was it a military craft? A wayward meteorite? Something else?
That's right. It to me, just after hearing the description, it sounds like what we've seen before on numerous videos with a meteorite breaking up as it's going through the atmosphere.
Right, because going through the atmosphere is a no bed of roses. It's a heck of a trip, and meteorites burn up, right?
Yeah.
So this story, we'll explore the evolution of this story, but for a while, people thought the case was largely closed until, that is, the 1990s. And listeners, some of you may remember a show called Unsolved Mysteries. Do you remember that one, Matt?
Oh, I definitely do.
I loved it. I remember seeing it. I guess it must have been reruns by then, but it came on after these reruns of ALF. And that was that was appropriate to me. It made sense to my kid mind. So when Unsolved Mysteries ran this episode on Kecksburg, or this segment rather, the, what should we say, We're a family show, so we'll just say the poop hit the fan almost immediately. And despite numerous, often contradictory reports, aspects of this incident remain unexplained today. So let's look at the initial reports, how the subsequent explanations changed, as well as words from the skeptics, words from those who were convinced that this was some sort of extraterrestrial object, and of course, the eyewitnesses.
That's right. And some of the people who witnessed this, they claim that they actually made it to the area, or at least close area, to where this thing, whatever it is, impacted. And according to some of the statements, they came upon a large metallic acorn-shaped object that was just in the ground that had hit. And it was one piece of solid metal. I think one person said bronze, gold in color. And it didn't have any kind of rivets in it or anything like that. It didn't have seams. It didn't appear to be created out of a bunch of man-made materials, you know, the way you would see an aircraft.
Sure. Like an aircraft at that time would have visible rivets. You could see clear marks of construction. It's interesting because one of the witnesses, well, several actually, claim they saw markings that resembled Egyptian hieroglyphics. And Matt, this reminds me of...
That's weird.
Yeah. It reminds me of the... the Roswell crash reports that we did some videos on. I'm going to go ahead and say that we didn't see any clear photographs of this thing. At least you and I haven't found any. But some reportedly, reputedly, allegedly exist. Let's go back to a witness statement. There's a guy who was, by the time his interview came around, he was a retired machinist named Jim Romansky. And at the time of the event, he was an 18-year-old volunteer firefighter. He said he saw the object and looked like it was liquid metal poured into a mold. And we can look more at this later, but let's introduce one of the most important witnesses for this story.
A name you need to remember is John Murphy. Now, at the time, he was a brand new director of WHJB in nearby Greensburg, which is...
It's a radio station.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A radio station gentleman. And remember, John Murphy. Now, he received word of this event from a listener, which is kind of cool, right? That idea that you're sitting there doing your job as you know, on the air, and then, what? This thing, mysterious thing crashed and you're stuck in a room and, you know, you're trying to get in as much information as you can. I am so jealous of John Murphy in this instance.
Well, yeah, people still will call radio stations. And so he's the director. I imagine he's sitting somewhere very much where you're sitting, Noel, directing things, right? Okay. Yeah. He really can't hear us. So back to the story. Yes. He receives, a call from a listener named Frances Kalp. She reports that something crazy had happened. The sky is falling. Well, maybe not all of it, but some of it. Well, maybe not some of it, but one flaming object has fallen near her home. She said that she and her kids approached this thing, and they got about a half mile away from it, and they saw what she described as a four-pointed star. So what'd Murphy do?
Well, first of all, let's just point out that a four-pointed star is a very different description than we've heard before, right?
Yeah, for all the other stuff, right.
Okay, so she calls the Pennsylvania State Police, and they asked her to meet and lead them to where she found this thing. Now, back to John Murphy. He called the Pennsylvania State Police after he heard of this, and he asked Kalp, the lady that we just said who went out and saw the thing, to meet and then lead them to where she saw it. Then Murphy himself drives out to check it out. And here's the thing. We don't know who made it there first. Was it Murphy? Was it the cops?
Yeah, his wife, Murphy's wife, Bonnie Murphy, said that she believes her husband made it out there first.
Okay.
But as far as whether how true that is, we don't know. We do know that Murphy interviewed Frances Kalp and her kids at the scene, and he also ran into state police officials, Carl Metz and Paul Shipko. And after they walked out of the woods, they were evasive to Murphy, or he found them evasive. When he asked what they had seen, and they all they said was that the military would be involved. So Murphy did what so many of us have probably done when we're not happy with our interactions with an organization. He escalated it.
Yeah.
Know? So Murphy, however, was not one to be cowed or intimidated, and he called Metz and Shipko's boss. He called the state police captain, whom I believe was named Dusa, D-U-S-S-A. Dusa responded pretty favorably and invited Murphy to come to the police office in Greensburg to hear the official statement from the feds. Members of the Army and the Air Force were there, and we have their official statement, the quote at least, right?
Mm-hmm. The Pennsylvania State Police have made a thorough search in the woods. We are convinced that there is nothing whatsoever in the woods.
Nothing. We found nothing.
Not even trees or wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Zilch, zip.
Nothing to see here.
Yep. Zilch, zitch, not a surf. So Murphy takes this statement, and obviously he doesn't believe it. He overhears officers talking about a pulsating blue light, and when he learns that they're going to return to the site, he asks them if he can come with them, and they say yes, but when they get to the woods, he's not allowed in there. The military has reportedly cordoned off the area, you know, put the tape up, put some guards around the perimeter, restricted access. And then several witnesses say that they saw a large flatbed truck leaving the same spot with a conical object of some sort under the tarp, after which the military began to leave as well.
Man, so put yourself in Murphy's shoes here.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? You think that these guys are hiding something that, you know, it, depending on what it is, could have huge consequences on all of mankind, perhaps, or maybe even just your country if it's another country's thing that fell out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? Well, Murphy decides that he's going to work on a radio special called Object in the Woods. And he's interviewing witnesses, he's talking to as many people as he can and putting it on air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a few days before this special aired, witnesses began calling Murphy and requesting that he chop out the parts that they were in. And, you know, why would they want that? Well, they were fearing that the Army, whoever is really in control of the situation, maybe just the police, would somehow retaliate against them for even talking about this thing.
Hmm.
Now, after the show, men in suits visited Murphy. They went to his office. They spoke in this back room for about half an hour. They took his taped interviews when they left, and Murphy refused to talk about this incident again. Now, that's pretty crazy, right? That sounds like something you would write in a script.
Sure. It sounds very similar to numerous Men in Black stories and anecdotes. It's true, though, Matt. People do get visited, especially back then, people would get visited by the feds, just men in nondescript suits, you know. It did happen. Murphy's wife, Bonnie, noted that his research and the documents that he had been keeping were gone as well. And she never saw the photographs that Murphy took because he refused to speak about this incident. Allegedly, he gave a copy of the unedited full documentary to a man named Stan Gordon. But this unedited version of the documentary has also disappeared. Stan Gordon is someone who will come up later when we talk about the modern day. He is someone who you can check out if you believe there is something rotten in Denmark, or should I say rotten in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. Yeah. So let's look at some of these initial public statements, huh?
Okay. Well, the first one, the Spokesman Review, they published a story on December 10th. Called UFO Starts Many Fires. And in this piece, they claim that the object set a bunch of fires, or it started a bunch of fires when it landed and or crashed. There were lots of bursts of light that occurred when this thing came down, and also a lot of smoke before hitting the earth.
Now, in this story, this is a fairly short article, which you can look up for yourself online, and you'll see reports of different fires happening around different parts of the Pennsylvania area and outside of it. There's a report of somebody describing this as a volleyball-shaped object or volleyball mm-hmm. size. But we also have to keep in mind that for someone on the ground with a fast-moving object and a bright one, it can be very difficult for us to have a true understanding of the size of the object and the distance of the object. And this is something that's going to come up with some of the skeptical statements as well. Another funny thing happens. The Air Force changes the official report to state that instead of not finding anything in the woods, a meteorite fell to Earth. Most people accepted this explanation. The case seemed closed for decades. However,
that wasn't the last time the story would change.
Yeah, that's true, man. In the 1990s, as we said, this story hit the public eye and the public mind anew, thanks to the folks at Unsolved Mysteries. And this was controversial in the area.
Yeah, at the time, people who lived in Kecksburg really, you know, they were divided. Some people really didn't like the attention that this was bringing to their fairly small town. And, you know, I think there was even a petition that was gathered together and signed by a lot of people.
Sure, yeah. Some of whom just didn't want the show filmed. They weren't alive when it happened. They had never claimed to be witnesses. But they didn't want Unsolved Mysteries or television types stirring up more out-of-towners and violating privacy, I imagine.
It is interesting because it seems like it would be, I don't know, a boom to your small town if you
there's
tourism.
There's a UFO store there now. This tourist industry that sprouts out around these things is definitely in swing there. After the show, more witnesses came forward, and we'll call them self-identified witnesses because they don't have a lot of confirmation. So these are anecdotes. One person was a United States Air Force officer who was apparently tasked with guarding this flatbed truck we mentioned earlier and told it was bound for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Another one was a building contractor who apparently transported a load of 6,500 quote, special bricks, whatever the heck that is, to a hangar inside Wright-Patterson. This is an Air Force base. And he looked inside and he claims that he saw this bell-shaped device with some men wearing these, you know, the white radiation suits TV before.
The radiation protection suits, yeah.
And he said these guys are looking at it, going all over it, just trying to figure out either studying it or something.
And they start escorting him out and tell him.
They say he just saw an object that in 20 years would become common knowledge.
And we do know, okay, I have to say this in point of fairness, Matt. We do know that especially in terms of aircraft, that is completely possible.
That's about right, 20 years.
Not just for the United States to do it, but for other countries, you know, China, Russia, probably several European countries have that capability. But the United States is one of the biggest in the game. So, as soon as this happens, as soon as Unsolved Mysteries runs this thing, numerous other shows begin focusing on Kecksburg, and they're tantalizing the UFO believers with things that are not quite answers, and they're doubtlessly irritating the heck out of, you know, like the overly emotional skeptics.
Yes.
So the question is, what exactly landed? We have several possibilities, right?
The first one, like we said at the top, and then was the official story for a while
A
meteorite.
Right, yeah, and that's clearly possible. I mean, 18,000 to 84,000 meteorites that are larger than 10 grams hit Earth every year.
Yeah, and then if you look at something like the Geminid meteor shower, I mean, it was in progress at the time. Of course, astronomer Louis Winker from Penn State, he doesn't think anything could have survived the passage through the atmosphere to the ground, at least that would match up what people saw at the Kexford incident.
Right, yeah. Then we'll go ahead and throw it out there. There's the possibility of an unidentified, non-man-made object. And this, one of the big things that people use as proof of this is that there is proof of secrecy, shifting stories, official sources contradicting one another. But again, the big question is, if there really was an extraterrestrial thing, then how on or off Earth could it be kept secret for so long? That's asking a lot, especially if people already, you know, especially if we have a guy who's working on a documentary, if we have all these other people coming forward and saying stuff. Yeah, you have to wonder what else. That is an extraordinary claim. But there are other claims that people put a little bit more, give a little bit more consideration to.
Perhaps. What if this thing was a Russian satellite, specifically the Venus Cosmos 96 satellite?
Ah, yes. Now that is an excellent question, and that's still one of the front-running theories. There is a Soviet satellite spacecraft expert named James Oberg, who I think we've mentioned in a couple of other shows before. He is a UFO skeptic, but he also believes that he's also skeptical, or was for a while, about this Cosmos 96 satellite, because he said, like, the timing might not match up. But later he came up with a possible explanation. He said that the Cosmos 96 had been set to re-enter the atmosphere and crash in Canada 13 hours before. So that would put it at, you know, around 3 in the morning, a little after 3 in the morning. He has an interview in Omni magazine where he says that maybe what entered the area at that time instead was a rocket booster, and that the probe itself fell to Earth and crashed in Keksberg. But this leads us down a really interesting thing that I want to give a shout out to, because the Russian and American forces at this time had sort of a handshake agreement with, you know, if a U.S. satellite falls in something under the Russian sphere of influence. Notice I don't just say Russia. If something falls in the U.S. sphere of influence, then we will get it and we will give it back to you.
Sure.
However, that may not have always been the case, but it would explain massive secrecy, because the Air Force apparently had a secret operation called Project Moondust, and their purpose was to get any foreign space probes that crashed. So their purpose was kind of to secretly get around this informal agreement.
I would just like to point something out here. I can't imagine someone from, you know, fairly middle of nowhere, Keksberg, Pennsylvania, seeing a ship that has a bunch of Cyrillic written on it, might just associate it with something that is not a... I hate to say this because it sounds like I'm saying some of the witnesses were either not intelligent or just didn't understand what Russian looked like, but perhaps they didn't.
It is possible. I mean, a lot of people aren't reading Cyrillic as a percentage of our population, even today in the United States. You know, that's why being able to read and speak Russian is such an incredibly valuable skill.
Or any
foreign language, really. It's true, man. A lot of us here in the United States are not polyglots. So
me, but yeah, I can imagine that. Or you know, you could always say, well, what if Russia was getting, or the Soviet Union was getting tricky and putting hieroglyphs on their satellites just for fun?
Sure, it is totally possible. The other thing here is there's a possibility that it was a secret United States project that crashed to the ground. That is so possible. That could happen today. Let's just go ahead and just to depict other things that are secret that the United States could have crashed to the ground somewhere. X-37B.
Big time.
An unmanned spacecraft that just goes out in space and hangs out for days, months.
But what does it do, Ben?
You know, that is such a great question. Matt is busting my chops a little bit, because I went through a period where I would come up to your desk pretty much every day, and even though it was clear that neither of us knew what the X-37B was doing, I would kind of harass both of us.
Yeah, I mean, it was fun. It was a troubleshooting something that is impossible to solve.
But what does it – anyway, that's a story for a different show. And hopefully that news will come out soon. So There's another possibility that I read about on a more skeptical-sided site, which we'll talk about at the end, that just says, nope, this Kecksburg incident, this was all a confusion. Nothing landed. There was a Great Lakes fireball at the same time. And that due to the problems of perception that humans have on the ground looking in the sky, that people thought it was closer than it was, it wasn't actually anything there. I don't know if I don't know how much I believe that because of some later statements. So let's go to the modern day where we meet a sharp journalist from New York City named Leslie Keene.
Leslie Keene filed an FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request with NASA, and she ended up in a lawsuit against NASA.
And this was with the Sci-Fi Channel. So let's be clear about this. She had a big supporting patron behind her that enabled this kind of David against Goliath thing. In December 2005, NASA said that they examined metallic fragments from this object and claimed that it was a Russian satellite, that it really was a Russian satellite. The NASA spokesman said that, by the way, we lost the records of this.
Yeah, we just can't find them.
Yeah.
Shucks.
Yeah, we can't. And if this was true, then, you know, they said they lost it in the 1990s. And in their statement, they say that, what they can't track UFOs. So what they did, was to take a look at whatever did fall and give their expert opinion, their best guess, right? But that, like, we don't know how much that bears out because as part of this work on the Sci-Fi show, Leslie Keene had people check the orbital paths of all known satellites and other records from the period in 65. And the expert she had checking said that it was absolutely impossible for any part of the Cosmos 96 Venus probe to have accounted for either the fireball or any object at Kecksburg. And these experts said, furthermore, there were no other man-made satellites or other objects that re-entered the atmosphere that day.
Well, according to the official records.
Right, yeah. And then, speaking of records, people have noted, you know, the same thing you and I are noting here, like, how questionable is it that NASA could lose records? I think, you know, I think that if it really is a Russian satellite in the middle of the Cold War, a Russian satellite fell to the United States, right? And now we're decades and decades away from this event. It's strange that, Matt, I will say it. Maybe the records were honestly lost. But if they were purposely lost, if they were destroyed, what prevents NASA from saying, yeah, we destroyed them? Like, what prevents that from coming to light? Is there a statute of limitations? Is it something that still impacts national security?
Yeah, and what happens? What are the consequences of, oh, man, we misplaced some documents? Are there any consequences? I can't imagine that there would be any because, oh, it was a clerical error or this happened.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it may well be that more information emerges about this and solidifies what we do know or what witnesses are saying. But now it's time for us to follow up on some of our earlier mentioned players. What happened to John Murphy?
Well, apparently he never spoke about whatever conversation that he had with the men in suits, let's call them. Like he just never even talked about it to anybody that we have record of. After the airing of the heavily censored documentary that he made.
Yeah, a few years after, right? 1969, I think.
Exactly. He went on to vacation. He went to Ventura, California. And unfortunately, when he was out there, he was killed in a hit-and-run accident.
And after his death, his wife, who we mentioned earlier, Bonnie Murphy, said that her husband really did have photos of an object, but that they were confiscated, these photos. She's saying something really did land. Mm-hmm. The state police confiscated it, and he was threatened with grave consequences, grave enough and believable enough, at least, that he was silenced on this for life.
That's very intense. I can imagine, as someone with a family, that if someone threatened mm-hmm. my family, then I would have to think very long and hard about my moral high ground or my instincts to want to go after the truth mm-hmm. for something like this. That's scary to me.
Well, it's a situation, you know, if that kind of stuff occurs, when that stuff kind of occurs, we know it's a situation that is not unique, that really has happened in the mm-hmm. past. And not necessarily, you know, with one particular country or one particular government or administration. This stuff is happening today to journalists across the world for myriad reasons. Mm-hmm. Don't report on corruption in, was it Venezuela?
Yep.
There are different things. Being a journalist is a very risky and stressful lifestyle, I understand. But we do have some further reading. We've only been able to look at, I guess, a little bit beneath the surface of Kecksburg, and we want to hear from you. Do you think this is a meteorite? Do you think this is a foreign technology? And if so, how foreign? USSR? China? Non-terrestrial? So let's go toward, just to end on some further reading here. I'll start with just the skeptical thing. We mentioned that some of the skeptical sides had claimed this event in Kecksburg was confused with the Great Lakes fireball. And that's from a site called debunker.com. And they say that the Kecksburg crash itself is sensationalism. And they have some great sources if you want to check this out. One of them, they cited a 1996 issue of Sky and Telescope magazine, where a professor of geophysics and geology named G.W. Weatherhill says the following.
The fireball was observed by many people in Ontario, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and to a lesser extent in the neighboring states. In newspaper accounts, a great many supposed impact sites were reported, both in southwestern Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio. Fragments were claimed to have fallen in Ohio and Michigan. These imagined happenings arose from the impossibility of estimating the distance of an object in the sky. Almost everyone who saw the fireball thought it was much closer than it really was. When it disappeared behind a house or a tree, many people thought it had fallen only a few hundred yards beyond.
And that's a really important thing, because the Weatherhill is bringing up two concepts here. The first, we know is true. It is incredibly difficult, maybe impossible with the naked eye, to estimate the distance of an object in the sky. Secondly, so people thought it was much closer than it really was. Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, he's saying there were numerous possible crash sites from debris, right? Mm-hmm. So not one Kecksburg, but many. Who knows how many? This is interesting, but, you know, of course, we want to present that side of the argument and see what you think about it. If you want to get some in-depth information on something that explores Kecksburg in more of a conspiratorial side of mm-hmm. the story and goes into much more depth than the mainstream TV shows, then do check out the work of Stan Gordon. If you look at some of his stuff, which you can find available online, we would love to hear your views. Tell us what you think happened on the afternoon of December 9th, 1965 in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, or what didn't happen.
So find us on Twitter, guys. Find us on Facebook. We are at Conspiracy Stuff on both of those. You can go to our website, stufftheydontwantyoutoknow.com. We've got all of our audio podcasts like this there. Hopefully you're listening to this on there. If you are, thanks, dude or lady. Before we go, Ben, one more thing we wanted to address.
Oh, yes. We wanted to thank everybody who checked out our one of our recent audio podcasts on race and policing in the United States specifically. And we received some great feedback on this. both in terms of constructive criticism and in terms of valid pointers for where to head next. Mm-hmm. One of the best points, at least in my opinion, was that we were talking about arrest rates and incarceration rates, but we weren't talking about the rates of the crimes that were committed in the same way. So we heard this, and we would like to explore this. We're going to look at crime. We have some stuff that touches on it earlier. You know, we've talked about militarization of police. We talked about
prisons, profits,
yeah,
immigration.
Privatization, yeah. And we've also explored, I don't know if we've done it in this show, but in some other shows, we've explored some of the problems of having a bigger society and whether people are hardwired to only be able to consider a couple of a smaller number of people, human beings. It's called the Dunbar's number.
Was that Brain Stuff? I think that was an episode you did of Brain Stuff.
Yeah, it was on Brain Stuff. We should also check it out there. We're going to head out. There is another thing that we'd like to cover in more depth later. I don't know when we'll get to it, but that is the Brazilian version of Operation Blue Book. We hope you stay tuned for that. And we hope you check out our video coming up later on this week, Is Your Government Building UFOs?
And that's the end of this classic episode. If you have any thoughts or questions about this episode, you can get into contact with us in a number of different ways. One of the best is to give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. If you don't want to do that, you can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.